Right, y'all. I just want to take a quick second to talk about our sponsor, Sunbasket. I don't know if you know this about me, but I am not a big fan of grocery shopping or meal planning or anything that goes along with any of that. But I do very much care about eating healthy. But when you don't like to grocery shop or plan meals, it is really hard to cook healthy dinners for your family. And that's where Sunbasket comes in. They're a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your door. Each week, you can choose from a brand new selection of quick and easy meal kit recipes with a wide variety of dietary options, plus dozens of snacks, salads, breakfast items, and more. And you can pick and choose from recipe options like vegetarian, Mediterranean, carb conscious, the list goes on. We just had orzo bowls with broccoli, sun-dried tomatoes, and pea stew, and it was delicious. My kids even liked them. I can't speak to Sunbasket more. I love them. Thanks to Sunbasket's commitments to clean ingredients and organic fresh produce, there's no easier way to eat your very, very best. You just have to go to sunbasket.com/queerfam today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/queerfam to save $120, y'all, across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. Go do that. Get some healthy food. There you go. This episode is sponsored by Feather Snack. Okay, hold on, y'all. I have to tell you about something that my wife got us into and that my whole family is loving now. Brace yourselves. It's the Feather Snap Scout Smart Bird Feeder. Yes, I said bird feeder. This thing is so cool, and it offers a brand new way to connect with nature and learn about the birds right in your own backyard. Or, if you're like us, living in New York City, it's in your friend's backyard in the country, and you get to use the app connected to it to learn all the stuff. It's got this high-resolution camera that connects to an app, so you can check out a live stream from your feeder. You can take photos and videos of the birds that visit. You can ID the species using expert-trained AI, and you can earn badges along the way. You can even, y'all, learn fun facts about hundreds of species. For example, did you know that American crows can recognize and remember people's faces? And they can even teach their young who's a friend and who's a foe? I know that now. Did you? Seriously, the Feather Snap Feeder is entertaining, it's educational, and it's just a whole bunch of fun for the whole family. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. This episode is brought to you by our newest Patreon member, Carrie Cook. Thank you. Thank you, Carrie. I could not do this without you, and I am so grateful to all of you for making this show a possibility.
The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jamie.
Tom is back.
I must have done something right.
Yeah, Tom is back as my guest co-host to help introduce this particular episode. Tom also guest co-hosted it a couple episodes back, which was so fun, so I had to have him come back. And Tom's original episode is all the way back in season one. So yes, y'all have to go listen because Tom has a beautiful story, and we're going to dive a little bit more into your story and how it's going now.
Okay.
But...
What do I know?
Well, here's why I thought this would be a wonderful episode for you to join, because you are a known donor to a lesbian couple.
Correct.
And our guests who are coming in, Maria and Ray, they both also used known donors. And their stories are different than yours. And so that's why, yeah, I thought, oh my God, all the perspectives of the known donors, which is amazing. Give an overview of the sitch.
Sure. So the lesbian couple with whom I'm friends with, they had mentioned, like, you know, oh, we're thinking about starting a family. And I came right out with it. And I said, oh, do you need a sperm donor? And they looked at each other and they looked at me and they said, oh, you are on our list to consider. And I was like, oh, all right. It just kind of moved forward from there. We continuously met for dinners and it was all about conversation. And it really was about a year and a half of just sort of you know, checking in and meeting and talking and what they wanted and what I wanted. And they knew that they wanted to have a known donor. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, it was not something I had thought about previously. So I didn't really have any preconceived mm-hmm. thoughts about really what I wanted. Mm-hmm. I kind of just worked on gut instinct. We checked all the respective boxes for each other. And then I started doing my banking in January 2005.
What you mean by the banking is the depositing of the sperm in the sperm bank or in the fertility clinic.
That is exactly what I mean. just to dovetail into the episode, actually, I was curious, and I think you had actually mentioned that somewhere when you're dealing with the bank, mm-hmm. that there's something that's written that says this is only for us. Mm. And I found that interesting because I explicitly remember when I was doing not paperwork for the lab, but when I actually was doing like the legal paperwork, I remember there actually was, now mind you, this is 2005, 2006, like early, like yeah. before this was a really regular thing. Uh-huh. I remember there was something explicitly in that paperwork that said something like it was giving them the ability to like transfer the sperm or whatever. And because I explicitly remember saying to the lawyer, no, that has to come out. It's not for anybody else. It's only for them. So that struck me as interesting that I heard that.
Yeah, because this route, wow, such a beautiful, beautiful option for us can come with some complications, and you got to make sure everything mm-hmm. is buttoned up nice and tight because yeah. you don't want things to go south, and they can go south yeah. if you're not all on the same page and things aren't signed and agreed to.
Yeah,
that's why I just love having your perspective, because you're a known donor and you're a known donor who it's all worked out for you, and you're still, you know, you still have a good positive relationship with the whole family.
Yeah.
But last time you were on, we kind of talked a little bit about your parents and your siblings and how you being a known donor has been for them. And some folks wrote in and said, I want to hear more about that from Tom. I want to hear about what it's like for him and his immediate family. So
yeah, just as far as my family goes. So my dad's passed. My dad died in 2017. Currently it's just my mom, my two older sisters, and I have a twin brother. All of my siblings are married. All of them have kids. Mm-hmm. All interesting family dynamics. My older sister has a quote, traditional nuclear family, mm-hmm. married, straight couple, one boy, one girl, who are my niece and my nephew are 36. Yeah, I know. That's fine. And then my middle sister has two kids who are both adopted. Oh. And then my twin brother, also married. My brother converted to Judaism. So it's like, I kind of call us like the true modern family, because I feel like all of our families are really built differently. Uh-huh. My brother has one son. And then there's me, who the known donor to a lesbian couple with three kids.
Right.
Interesting point that I actually have given my mother the most amount of grandchildren, natural grandchildren.
Yeah.
Three.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
So, you know, when I first started going down this path to do the donor stuff, the reactions from my family were all varied. And mm-hmm. I didn't tell my parents straight off, because my mom's 83 at the time. They were in their early 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Roman Catholic upbringing, both of them. My mother is very religious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like I had already been sort of uncomfortable, mm-hmm. or I didn't really feel like my sexuality was even normalized in my family.
Right. Yeah, you already hit him with the gay thing, basically.
And right. And now it's like, oh, and by the way, and now I'm going to donate sperm to a lesbian couple. So I'm having kids, but they're not really my kids. I'm not really I'm the father, but I'm really the parent, you know? So I chose to not say anything. And then I relocated. So my daughter was born actually 2 months before I relocated to Chicago. I lived mm-hmm. in Chicago for 2.5 years. And I moved back to New York 2013. And I thought, it's like, you know what? It's time. They need to know. My sons actually were at that point 6 months. Mm-hmm. I was at their house. I just kind of opened up the conversation. I said, so listen, I have to tell you something. And I told them, and I showed them pictures, and it was a very like unemotional mm-hmm. conversation. It wasn't histrionics or whatever, you know, one of those, like, you prepare yourself for the worst, and then it was totally fine. Mm-hmm. But like the response from them was not unexpected. Mm-hmm. They were like, you know, my father said, you know, for people of our generation, this is hard to understand mm-hmm. and hard to accept, but who, you know, in future generations, it would probably, you know, it won't be as so much of a it'd be a much more of a normal thing to consider or whatever. Mm. Shortly thereafter, I actually hosted a brunch at my apartment for my family to meet my kids
right.
and the moms, and my parents did not come. My parents, my ugh. Mother wrote, and she said, thank you, but I hope you understand, but we won't come. Ugh. And
not
it's
the response you want.
Yeah, not surprising.
Right. But that also is like so frustrating that it's not surprising. And it's like, okay, I thought this would go this way. Oh, well, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah. To this day, the only nieces and nephews that know my situation are my oldest two. My niece, Jacqueline, who's 38, and my nephew, John, who's 36, and their respective families. Oh, my nieces and nephews that are under 18, under the age of 18, know Uncle Tom's gay.
Right.
But they don't know about this part of my life.
Oh, my God.
You know, I think I intimated this when I last co-hosted with you, was that I had a, you know, I had a family meeting with my sisters and my mom to kind of like get some personal life stuff out on the table and to say like, get on board, this is my life and blah, blah. And I brought up the fact that there was not really a true relationship with my kids. And my sister sort of said, not really defensively, but she sort of said, well, there really hasn't been an invitation from either side, which, you know, and it as if, you know, as if to say, like, you know, it was never really, the olive branch wasn't extended from my family to my sister's kids to be like, oh, we're having a birthday party, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You know, do you want to come? Which it never occurred to me. And again, shame on me for maybe not having the level of comfort that I feel like I should have had to be able to make that happen more. But to this day, like, I mean, so my sisters didn't meet the kids during that one brunch moment, but my boys were two. My daughter was four.
Right.
You know, and then, but they haven't, I mean, they've seen pictures. I send pictures all the time. They're very responsive to it, but there's really no familial integration, you know, at all.
Yeah. So I guess that's something like, you know, if you're somebody who's thinking of being a known donor yourself, like this is an aspect that you don't necessarily completely go through in your head. Like you didn't, like, what is my family's relationship going to be to the children and the family that is created? How are we going to incorporate my immediate family with my new family? And how is it all going to, so many things to think about. So many things.
Yeah. The way I figure it is all my nieces and nephews are going to get older. And the older they get, the more capacity they'll have for me to be able to tell them that there's this other part of, there's more family members you have not met yet. And in my head, I just have like, at some point where they're all of a reasonable enough age to have the understanding that I'm going to just have this like huge like party and just have them all like just have them
cousins.
All like meet finally, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, Right. I have five nieces and nephews and I have four great nieces and a great nephew now too.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot more that they haven't experienced or that they haven't, a lot more people that they haven't met. So.
And the only thing I'm going to push back here, I'm going to venture to say that they're not necessarily too young to know now. Their families are just not ready for them to know.
That is not pushing back. That is 100% truth.
Right. Well, okay. So we have to roll the tape. We have to get into Maria and Ray's story. Yes. And they have these Instagram accounts that are like in your face kind of birthing and pregnancy accounts. And they show it in all its rawness and all its realness. And I appreciate it immensely because it takes away that whole mystery and stigma that we put on this stuff. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's also really ugly and gross sometimes. They're pushing the boundary. They're pushing the needle. And I really appreciate that about them. So I'm really excited to introduce this episode. And everybody needs to go out and buy their book, which they will explain how you can get it and all the things. And it will be linked in the show notes for everybody. So I think
I want to say that this episode is really, really eye-opening for me and very educational for me. It has all the acronyms in it. Like, I had to, because quite honestly, not familiar with what the females have to go through. I had to look up some of these acronyms and understand what they were talking about. And thankfully I learned so much. Oh, so
good. That is the whole point of this whole thing. About you that you actually took the time to look it up. Good for
you. Well, yeah, because as anything, like if I'm listening to something and I want to understand the full context, I'm like, wait, pause. What is that?
Okay.
Now I understand. IUI and HSG were the two that I had to actually look up.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talk about those a lot on this show.
Yes, you do.
We got to roll the tape. Beautiful stories and also really funny. So we got to get into it. Tom, would you like to ask Helen and Beulah to roll the tape? The crotchety ladies sitting in the corner who don't do anything except push a damn button, but I still keep them on.
You're employing people, Jamie. You're employing a lot of people. You're employing Helen and Beulah. Helen, Beulah, hey, over here. Roll the tape. Roll the tape, please. Thank you.
Queer Family Podcast.
Wait, Helen, before you roll that tape, this is Jamie's daughter, Rose. I have to tell you that you should join my mom's Patreon. My mom's Patreon. My mom works really hard on the show, but even with the sponsors, she really doesn't make enough profit to hire a real assistant or a team. So please go to Patreon. Patreon. Please go to Patreon. Please go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast and join now. You'll do a good thing and get bonus content. She really loves this stuff.
Love is love is love is love.
Hi, Maria and Ray.
Hi, Jamie. Hi.
It's very wonderful to have you here. Where are you coming in from in the Zoom?
I am in Santa Cruz, California.
Ah.
And I'm in West Philadelphia.
Wow. Well, I'm in New York and I'm from San Francisco, so I know Santa Cruz very well. Let's get right into your elevator pitch. Tell the listeners who you are and why you're here. You have 30 seconds to do it, but I will never cut you off. But I am going to put a timer up just to make you kind of nervous. Yeah. On your marks, get set, go.
We are queer millennial home birth midwives and midwives who do IUI, who became friends on Instagram right as we were in like kind of embarking on our parenting journeys, and somehow managed to write a book about how to get pregnant if you're queer or a single parent. And the book's coming out in a few weeks. It's Baby Making for Everyone.
Dang, Ray, that was so efficient. Nice job.
That was it. That was amazing. Are we done or do you have anything to add, Maria?
I have nothing to add. Ray did that perfectly. I'm happy to talk more about myself and our personal lives and whatever you want to, but I feel like that was
a very nice well intro. Done. Well, before we get into your midwifery practices and the book, let's talk a little bit about your home lives because you're both also queer parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd love to hear a little bit about your parenting journeys, how it all started and where it's at now. So why don't we start with Maria, if it's okay with you.
Mm-hmm.
What does your family look like?
Yeah, I am married to another midwife, actually.
Wow.
We have three kids. I gave birth to our youngest, who just turned two, and she gave birth to our almost 13-year-old and 5-year-old.
Wow. And did you... Yeah. The both of you create the babies together, all of the children, or is this a blended situation?
No. Yes, we have a blended family. So we were friends. We met each other through the midwifery community in Oakland, where we were living at the time. And she had Amada, our oldest, with a donor as a solo parent by choice. And she loved being a solo parent and was just thriving. And then she was like, I want to do this again. I want to have another baby. And I was like, that's awesome. I'm going to support you as a friend. And she actually taught me. She was the first person to teach me how to do IUIs.
Oh, okay.
And then we had our first kiss a week before she conceived of this next baby. We dated. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen with us. And I wanted to proceed with caution because it's a big deal to date a parent. And we were dating when our now 5-year-old was born. And it wasn't until our kid was about 9 months old that we like committed and I became a parent and we moved in together and blended our families more officially. And then in 2020, I got pregnant with the same donor that Andrea had used.
Oh, for the middle one.
For the middle one. Yep. And now I have three awesome kids. I am so grateful that she trusted me enough to invite me into that process. And it did take time to really be able to like integrate it all. Like I felt pretty overwhelmed for the beginning, but I do feel like something shifted when I got pregnant myself and I gave birth, and it just really helped like solidify our family. And I also feel like it helped me expand my capacity as a parent. So yeah, it's been quite a journey. It's been an amazing journey and I love my family so much.
Oh, I love your family too.
No, thank you.
We're going to dig deeper into more about your family. But before we do that, I want to ask Ray about your family. Ray just basically just gave birth. I'm watching you and you're doing the new mom rock, like here and there. You know, when you have a newborn, you find yourself just constantly rocking. I'd be waiting for the bus, just rocking back and forth.
I did not know I was doing that. So I am married to my partner, Asher, who is a trans personal trainer. They also do like social media-y things at Non-Normative Body Club. We'll just give them a shout out.
Cool.
And we've been together for a decade. We met my first month in midwifery school, and neither one of us were interested in getting into a relationship, and they had another partner. But little by slowly, like, we've somehow been together for a decade now. And when we decided to get married, it was ultimately, there was the decision that we were going to have kids together. Mm-hmm. And we kind of had a long donor saga and then a long conception process. But I gave birth to our baby on New Year's Day in my bathroom. And it was so painful. And also like the coolest thing I've ever done. So I have a 2-month-old.
God, there's so much to ask. There's so much to unpack. I want to talk donors. I want to talk the donor search. Ray, since we're with you, can we dig into your donor situation?
So my partner really wanted to have a genetically related child, and they were on T. They really didn't feel like their body is available for that, and nor do we have any insurance coverage for reciprocal IVF.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Of course not. We have no insurance coverage for any of this. So we initially asked their brother to be our donor, and he took almost a year. Like, he actually asked for more time and we said no. He'd tell us, I'm not ready, but maybe for the next kid. And we were just like, what?
A year? The fact you're patient. The fact that you waited that year out too is pretty amazing.
I think like my partner had a conversation with him when they were 20, and like it seemed like that was an option, but like when push came to shove, it actually wasn't.
Right.
And so there was a lot of loss. And so then we asked another family member on my partner's side, and he said yes. Pandemic happened, and we're like doing directed donor across the country, you know, with the sperm bank during a pandemic. And we're at that point, we're so desperate to start trying, you know, how like there's like the FDA quarantine requirement so that like,
For this family member to send it and they have to do the quarantine on it.
Yeah. Like, so there's like this stupid FDA rule that just like turns into homophobia. That, you know, that's right. That like basically you have to test it for HIV and then wait 6 months and test it again. But you can like get around it if you can like have your healthcare provider, which is me, you know, sign a release saying that you can like use that sperm within like the same, like the 7 days that it was originally tested.
I didn't even know there was a way around that.
There is a way around
that. I did not even know.
But not all banks do it. And we were hoping we'd get enough sperm to do all of our IUIs. And like, we didn't. So then we had some vials and some of them were really crappy. And then he made more donations. So we had enough to do the amount of IUIs we planned. But then basically we had like one decent vial and 2 mediocre vials. And then our sperm was going to be in sperm jail for 6 months. And then like when our sperm got out of sperm jail, we had to repay to have him get lab work done. It was just like,
all of the blue tape, what do they call it? The red tape?
Yeah. You just like, it feels so gross how they're making money off of the situation. We like traveled to California once while our sperm was still in jail. And then I think
you keep calling it sperm.
And that's what it was. I felt like I was like in like queer fertility jail. And then I think the first IUI we did after our sperm got out of jail, I got pregnant and then miscarried at like 5 weeks. And
no,
it was just like,
you
know, I did 2 more IUIs and then I was like, we got to do something else. So then we asked my friend's ex-boyfriend for sperm and he was local. And
so we've gotten rid of the genetic tie.
Yeah. It was like Asher. They're like, I think like we gave it a really good try. And like, I now feel like I've like tried to have a genetically related child and I can like go through that sadness. Cause I see this process is killing you. Cause like the tracking for IUI sucks. You know, everything about queer fertility kind of sucks a little bit. Right.
And you know, a lot about it. Yeah.
It turns out you can be like an expert in fertility and it can take you a while to get pregnant. Like the experience has definitely made me much more empathetic to the people I care for. And also, you know, like while I'm trying to get pregnant, I have a home birth practice. So I'm like catching babies and then people are like getting pregnant again. And so they're having 2 babies with me in the time that I've been trying to get pregnant. And I'm like,
I feel you on that.
You just have sperm everywhere.
Not like, fair.
anyway, there's like a month or two gap while we're kind of getting ducks in a row with our new donor. And I'm just like, I can't wait anymore. And
so now you don't have to go through the bank. He's
now we're not going through the bank. I'm not doing IUI.
Directly handing you the
stuff. Yeah, delivery. There was like one time where we all like him and his girlfriend came over and we all like played Wingspan. And then he like went upstairs and like gave us sperm and then they left. You know, so versus like I've been doing home IUI with my midwifery partner, with a friend of mine, another midwife filled in once when I ovulated early. You know, it's just like everyone.
So you had like midwife friends coming in and inseminating you.
Yeah, all my friends were in my vagina that year. So as I was kept trying, it was getting harder emotionally. And then I kept thinking about like, you know, I know what is offered at fertility clinics. I know the risk benefit and just being like, you know, based on my age, based on this thing, like, I think this is still appropriate. I still want to process. I'd rather have it take a little bit longer and have more control than add interventions. And basically I had a lot of these, like when I started trying with this fresh donor, you know, my period would be like 2 days late. I felt like I was like, kind of like getting conception, but not implantation, like every cycle. And I was like, this is going to drive me crazy. And then I had like an actual chemical pregnancy on our third try. And I was like, oh, no. I've tried 10 times. I haven't conceived. It's time to start doing an infertility workup. Have no insurance coverage for any of this. So I start doing it on myself.
As you do.
Yeah. And then I like ask a friend to prescribe me Clomid. And so.
It's good to have friends in high places. Let me tell you.
I think being a home birth midwife, also like having a disability and having to navigate healthcare systems, I have really strong feelings about being in control of my process. And I was just like so not ready to turn my process over to what that system had to offer. And I was like, I can do that stuff myself. I finished my infertility workup like 2 days before my 12th insemination. Like we do an HSG with the doctor I do co-care with. That was like the last piece. And I was so scared of it. I was so scared of an HSG.
Why? Because of pain or because of what you might find out?
I think because of pain. Everyone I knew said it was like, who had done it, said it was so painful. And it didn't bug me at all.
I didn't feel it.
And then I got pregnant 2 days later.
That's how it goes.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
I got pregnant on my 12th insemination at home. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's an involved donor search.
Yeah. Like I mean, three people over like, I guess like two and a half years. And yeah.
That's a long struggle. I mean, we get crazy with these donor searches. These donor searches are no joke. You get kind of worked up.
It's a weird process.
Yeah. I was like, I don't really care. Like my partner, like there was this like drag queen in town who like was maybe a possible donor, but like his parents had both committed suicide. And Asher's like, that's a big mental health history. And I was like, I don't care. Or like, you know, we live actually, our house is attached to a frat house. And I was just like, can we just go over there? Like, I just like couldn't, just couldn't care. I was just like, there's sperm everywhere except when you need it.
That's
yeah, there's like 30 sperms next door. Like, you know.
Hundreds of thousands, really. But that's why I brought it up, because you didn't seem as like caught up in the things that a lot of us get caught up in. However, your search was still extremely difficult. These donor searches are involved and tough.
Right. And it's like, you know, there are ethical considerations to like someone, because I think like known donor was important for us. Like initially it was genetic connection, so my partner could have a genetically related child. And then when we let go of that, we like still wanted our child to like know where their genes were and where they came from. And for that to always be an open and honest conversation. And so like having someone who like understood the boundaries was kind of where it was at.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that, because I want to come back to like kind of the conversation you had with the donor and what your agreement is surrounding your family and him. And, you know, I want to get back to that. But Maria, tell us about your donor story.
Yeah, my donor story is probably the quickest, easiest story that you've heard, because my wife already had found a donor, this like wonderful man in the community who was a friend of a friend who donated to her and then was just happy to also donate to me. And the original plan was to do, you know, at home inseminations, but COVID happened. But actually, to rewind a little bit, my Jewish mother, I have to give her credit, because, you know, like We've got a culture of like being prepared for disasters. So this was like pre-COVID. We had these two kids. I was in this blended family. She was like, man, you really should have your donor donate sperm to the bank and freeze it because you never know what could happen. And I was like, okay, mom, like that's a fine idea. And so we did it. And then it turned out that actually with COVID, we ended up using the sperm that we had frozen at the Sperm Bank of California. Wow. And doing IUI.
Okay, mom.
Yeah.
That's a win for mom.
Yeah.
I've talked to folks who have had their donor donate at a bank. When you do this, there's something you sign that says this is just for me, correct? Like, is there?
Yes.
Like, how does it work for the listeners?
You set up an account with the sperm bank. Mm-hmm. And then through that account, your donor donates into only your account. Like, they're not going to use that sperm for other people unless your donor is also donating to the general bank. Right. But you can set up a private account at a sperm bank, and then you just, that's like your quote unquote property, which sounds like a weird thing to say, but
yeah,
that's how it works.
Okay, good. Good to know. Good for listeners to hear.
Yeah.
So you ended up using the same donor as that your 5-year-old, which is beautiful and just the dream. And did both of you always want to carry?
For me, it's always been a thing. It's been like the one thing in my life. Like, I've always known that I wanted to be a parent, and I've had a very strong feeling that I wanted to experience pregnancy and birth and nursing. And something about that experience is like so compelling to me as a person and a midwife. And like, I just really see there's like so much beautiful potential for like transformation and healing in that process. Yeah. So, yeah.
And how about you, Ray?
I think it was probably like 5 years into doing birth work. Like, I became a doula when I was 21. I went to midwifery school at 25, and maybe like around 26, 27, I was just like, yeah, I think I want to do this. Like, I definitely became like interested in the idea of giving birth, but I was like, I don't really want a parent. I don't know. Like that.
Wife.
Babies. What? Like, I love them, but I was like, no, I like
it's a lot of work.
I just, you know, I want to go out till 4 a.m. And then, you know, like at some point you're just like, or for me at least, it was like, I've gone out enough. Like, I've, you know, I don't need to go to another gay bar.
Right.
Just like seeing the way that people looked at their babies and being like, I want to know what that love feels like. And that's why I wanted to carry.
Yeah. I was the same. I've always wanted to, and I've always wanted to experience childbirth. Mainly for that reason, I wanted to experience that like crazy transformative love the moment I meet the baby. And I'll tell you what. That didn't happen for me. It didn't happen. So it doesn't happen right away for everyone. And I do feel like it's necessary to put that out there. Sometimes it's a slow burn.
You know, and Ray and I talk about this in the book too. Like, we both were birth workers for almost a decade before being parents ourselves. And it's like there's knowledge that you can have as a provider, and you know about timing and how to advise people and the different tools that you need to have. But it's just different when you have that lived experience. And like, I think having that motto of it's not going to be what you expect is powerful and helpful, and also gives us like more gentleness in whatever our process turns out to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I had never appreciated when someone like came into my office pregnant and was like telling me that they were tired. Like, I never appreciated like how tired they were until I was that tired.
People really don't get
pregnancy tired is so much worse than like being up for 3 days at a birth tired.
And now you're in your fourth trimester.
I am.
Right? Is it what you expected? And what's some advice that you give new parents when they're going through this? And I'm talking about the bio parent and the non-bio parent, because we all go through some form of a fourth trimester, right?
Yeah. Most of my pregnancy was like trying to let go of expectations and just having to be like, I actually have to just become okay with whatever happens. And planning for the worst case scenario postpartum. Like, if every bad thing was going to happen, like, how do we need to be set up to like come out on the other side? Yeah. And I feel really proud of myself. Like, I feel like, yeah, I like really set us up well. And so like some of the things that were really important was like the first week at home, we had my friends who were birth workers staying with us. So we just like had people who knew how to care for us.
That's amazing.
And then like, we basically had a friend here for 4 to 6 days every week for the first 6 weeks. Wow. Yeah. We were just like had a lot of care. And then also I refused to let our families come for a while. I lied about my due date by a few weeks. I was just like, I don't want anybody texting me and asking me if I'm still pregnant.
Right, right.
Just, I really wanted to protect that time. And we like set the expectations with our family too, that like we weren't going to have visitors in the first like 3 to 4 weeks. And our mothers were pretty upset. And I am so glad I kept that boundary. And I think like 2 weeks in, Asher was like, oh, I get why you did that. And I was like, yeah, because the support was really just about us. Like we had chosen family who like knew how to care for us. I wrote out instructions for everyone about like, this is what we like to eat. These are the things that are going to be helpful around the house. Like these are the ways like we want to be supported. And so like anyone who like came in who wasn't a birth worker just like knew how to like kind of get in the rhythm. And my really close friend who was also my doula just coordinated everyone who came. So
you really set it up like you're not doing anything for this amount of time. And it's like you were convalescing. Like you set it up like we're convalescing and y'all need to get it together to support us in this way, in this way, in this way, in this way. And that's what we're going to do. Kind of amazing. That's completely opposite of my birth, but it's amazing. And nothing happened the way I thought it was going to.
I love this conversation because I think the way that Ray set themselves up is like how everybody should be treated in their postpartum. And in our culture, we don't, we don't know to do that. And I think, you know, we have such high rates of postpartum depression and it's just, it's fucking hard. Like it's a huge transition physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And when you create that little bubble for yourself, it makes such a big difference for ourselves and for babies. And I actually have a free course on my website. It's like how to prepare for the postpartum and like walking people through how to set themselves up because it's such a big deal.
It's really hard. And
it's hard.
And I have to say, like for me personally, I would have had to do a lot of personal work to get myself to a place where I could say, no, I'm taking this for me. That is not a part of my language. That's not a part of the way I do life. You know what I mean? And so that would be really hard for me.
Yeah. It's a big like spiritual shift to be like, oh, I deserve to be taken care of in this way. My baby deserves this. My family deserves this. Like it's not a lot of us who are assigned female at birth are socialized to not feel like we can take up that space.
Right. We don't and take space.
Yeah. And it's not actually serving anybody.
No. I want to ask also because you had two other kiddos when you were going through yours. And so that was an element to me too, because I had a four-year-old at home as well. Yeah. And so how do you navigate that? How did you do it?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
We had, so it was COVID. It was like kind of the height of a peak and we hadn't been having childcare, but what we ended up doing is we had this awesome babysitter on and off when our middle kid was little. And so she ended up like testing and moving in with us for the plan was like the month around my due date. And my wife is also a midwife who has also given birth. She gave birth twice. She really understood it. So we knew like what was needed. And I had a pretty big hemorrhage when I gave birth. And so my hemoglobin levels were really low and I was home and everything was fine, but I was really anemic, like couldn't get out of bed for the first 2 weeks. I was like peeing in a chamber pot next to the bed.
And
so I needed a lot of care, but I was also it was like the most amazing 2 weeks of my life. Like I was just so elated on the experience and the oxytocin and the connection. And then unfortunately we had a freak electrical fire in our house when I was 2 weeks postpartum.
Oh, no.
And in the middle of the night, and it was like super scary and we were trapped on our balcony and had to end up moving to close to where my parents are, and it just kind of messed up our whole process.
Oh god.
But those
see
first
you
two
can't
weeks,
plan everything.
Can't plan. You can try your best.
Life gets in the way. Life gets in the but we can try our best. You're right.
We can try our best. You know, as far as like with the older kids, just like setting expectations, and we like cuddled in bed a lot and did a lot of skin to skin. And I, you know, they were skin to skin with the baby. And what I like to tell my clients is first week in the bed, second week on the bed, and third week around the bed. And I really recommend, I mean, all Indigenous cultures all across the world, all across time, have some sort of practice of keeping the postpartum person inside and taken care of for usually about 6 weeks. And we do not have that in our culture. But the clients that do that and the people that can prioritize that, I really see a difference in their like mental, emotional, physical health.
Love is on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
All right, Queer Fam Squad. I'm coming in here because I have something really important to talk about right now. My friend Anna, a podcaster of the Queer News, is here because she told me she was doing this thing called, what do you call it, Anna?
I'm calling it Feed Swap Fridays.
Feed Swap Fridays. And I thought that sounded so cool. So we are doing a feed swap. We are doing a feed swap this week. You are going to hear one of Anna's episodes. Anna, can you tell us a little bit about your podcast?
Yeah, it literally is Queer News. I'm reporting on politics, entertainment, and culture at the intersections of race and sexuality. We have a good time.
I love it. And as you know, at home, listeners, I would never, ever, ever share anything with you that I didn't think you were going to love. And I think you're going to love this podcast. So can you tell us a little bit about the episode you're sharing with us?
Yeah, it's our episode that we actually won the Ambie for. So it's the episode.
A little mic drop moment there.
Hey, you know, it's going to come with me everywhere. It has not yet gotten old. But the episode is Change the Pattern. And so it's about my journey of learning about the AIDS quilt, also learning about the Change the Pattern initiative through the National AIDS Memorial. And I actually had the opportunity to follow the quilt around as they launched the Change the Pattern campaign, which is looking to take the quilt down south and to get more Black and Brown names and lives honored on the quilt. The quilt is 57 miles long, and less than 2 miles of it actually tells the stories of Black and Brown folks who have been impacted by HIV and AIDS. Yeah, so they started to change the pattern. That's what this episode is about.
I just learned something new already. Y'all have to tune in. It's coming this week. You have to tune in and listen to this episode. And then you need to go follow and subscribe Queer News and everything else Anna Deshawn does. That's all I have to say there. So tune in this week, y'all. It's going to be bomb. I love it. Anna, I love you. Thank you so much.
Love you back.
Queer Family Podcast.
I want to get into this known donor agreements. And I want to ask each of you, how did y'all go about like setting yourselves up for success with your known donors?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I feel like what we did is actually like in the book, including like Maria's known donor agreement is in the book.
Oh, nice. That's a good way to sell a book. Don't say anything else.
But because I think a lot of people are like, how do you ask for sperm? And it's like, start over email, because that's a little bit less awkward, and just be like, hey, this is who we are. This is why we're trying to start a family, you know, and we're wondering if you'd be open to like talking to us about the possibility of donating sperm to help us start a family. And so like when we first asked my partner's brother, we asked in person, and then with the cousin, we emailed, and then we had a follow-up phone conversation. And then when it came to my friend's ex, who like we kind of knew socially, our friend kind of like did a warm intro. And then we're like, hey, this is what's been going on. You know, we're looking to switch to like using a local donor. We have this agreement. We're also like very specific that we're like looking for someone who is going to like give us this really huge gift of sperm donation, and also understand that like we are the baby's only parents, but is like open to having their story that like this person was a part of helping us make our family like from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And we're open to different levels of connection in the baby's life, but that like we would be the only parents, you know. And then we like met in person, we had this conversation again, and then we sent him our known donor contract, which of course is one that has been passed around my queer community for quite a while. Like someone paid a lawyer at some point.
Queer drafting.
To write a known donor agreement. And then, and then it just keeps getting adopted and adopted and adopted. So that's what we used. Part of the agreement was that we asked our donor to get a semen analysis and STI testing. And we asked about his sexual health practices to make sure that that was in line with the level of risk that like I was comfortable being exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Do you plan on staying in contact with him?
We do. He met our baby for the first time, maybe like 2 weeks ago. It was cute. And it like also felt like affirming in this experience that like he's, you know, he's going to be part of our life. He wants to like watch this child grow up and also is not a parent. And then he's like, my sister wants to send you brownies. Is that okay? And we're like, I'm not going to say no to chocolate.
Right.
So it's just like a relationship that's kind of like unfolding. And it's like interesting to kind of, you know, like be getting to know someone while also like having this like very interesting connection to their family. And so I think we, you know, are of the belief that like the more people that love our child, the better. And also like the second the baby was born, we started the second parent adoption proceedings. And, you know, there's some pretty scary court cases in the last month or so. One just happened in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And he was on board and he's already signed. Like our lawyer in Pennsylvania, they have, since we're married, like my partner can be on the birth certificate, but like it seems like parentage is only for the time that we're married. So, yeah.
And
so,
and only in the state, I think.
And a birth certificate does not denote parentage.
Right.
Just
so,
identification, which is like, okay, so what's
what do you? What do you do with like, that? Yeah.
The freaking point of that. Okay.
So, but like in
but
Pennsylvania.
But if you're straight, it does. It really does. It's just implied.
I feel like, so like 3 weeks ago, we got the like packet from the lawyer of all the things we had to do. Mm. And like the packet with the list and then like the follow-up tasks, like I'm like, this list feels like homophobia. Like I have no executive function right now.
It took me like three years to get it done. It's sad. It's sad, but true. Because I kept looking at that list and being like, do this shit. Mariah, how about you?
Yeah, similar. I have so much love for our donor. He's a father. He has two kids and he's always been like very open and available. I think he came over for the first time when our middle child was almost one and we like had a sweet lunch together and they met and we have photos of them together. And my wife and I, we got married some years ago, but we had our wedding this past summer and we invited him and his kids and we all took pictures together and we have on our wall, we have a photo of him with each of the two kids that are genetically related to him. And we also have a photo of our oldest daughter with her donor.
Oh, wow.
Because we just want to like hold space for that relationship and honor it. And, you know, I think it can be helpful to kids and kind of understanding where they come from. And our 5-year-old knows all about sperm and eggs, you know, so we talk about it and just trying to normalize it. Like we don't have examples in our culture of what those relationships are and can be. And it's a process.
And our kids, the kids of the queer families are educating all those kids on the playground. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
Like my 9-year-old's like, no, it's a uterus. Have you ever heard of an embryo? You know what I mean? Like
totally.
You need sperm, you know?
Yeah, it's great.
It's so funny. I mean, they're going to change the world. They're going to change the world.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, I'll be scrolling Instagram and then all of a sudden I see a baby popping out of a vagina. And this is why I was first attracted to y'all, because you're putting something out there that is thought of as this taboo thing, but it's really such a beautiful thing. And you get banned a lot, don't you, for some of these posts? So you're really showing all sides of birthing on your social media platforms. If you don't follow them, it's Restore_Midwifery, everybody at home, and Refuge Midwifery. Right? Did I say it right?
Yes.
Talk about what your missions are.
I love that question. Being born is like the one thing that we all have in common. Like we've all been born. And I think over the years, we've really lost touch of like our animalness and the humanity in that birth process. And I feel like it's a profound experience. And there's so much potential for trauma and disconnection and also healing and connection. And so I feel like it's like medicine to our culture to see images of like empowered people giving birth and being connected to their babies and being connected to their bodies and being supported. And like that contradicts a lot of the kind of the culture that wants to separate us from our bodies, that wants to separate us from our like autonomy and our power and our babies and our families. So yeah, it's like, it really feels healing to me. And so I try to share that. I shared my own birth experience on my Instagram and I just started a YouTube account too. And like, I just think we need to see it. I think it's like fucking beautiful and transformative. And also for people who are about to give birth, knowing that that your experience can be like that. You know, there's so much fear. We see it like that movie Knocked Up, and it's like your water breaks and then you're screaming, you're going to the hospital, and it's like this huge emergency. And, you know, birth is actually a very normal experience. And sometimes, you know, there are complications and we need to intervene, and we're so grateful that we can helps birth be safer, but it is also a normal human physical experience. And so I really like demystifying that process.
Yeah, that's a good word. You're demystifying the birth process. And sometimes it's very loud and in your face, but that's what birth is, right?
Yeah.
Right.
My goal with Instagram is to increase access to the midwifery model of care through popular education, because, you know, we are home birth midwives. So, you know, we can't do that many births a year because we will be tired. And also, like, this is the United States. Less than 2% of people are having home birth. It's not going to be the norm, but we are in this really unique position where we can show people different avenues of birth. We can show people like different aspects of like queer conception, pregnancy, parenthood, and just like help build a conversation about options. And I think the more, you know, queer people that know that there are alternatives to like, you know, going to a fertility clinic, the more empowered they are, whether or not they're choosing to conceive in a clinic or out. It's just like, the more we know about the options, the better we also can like advocate for ourselves and like build power in like every healthcare setting.
Yeah, agreed. And that's why the work that you two do is so important. That's why this podcast is important, to tell the stories, to open up the conversation so that people can see the choices. I've learned so much since having these conversations. And I didn't know the at-home insemination was a real option for me when we started. Now, I've interviewed so many folks that I think I might have gone that route, but it was too late. It's too late for me. But you know what I mean? It is really, really important to show all of the choices and all of the options.
Yeah, I think it's a reproductive justice issue. You know, people should be able to not have babies if they choose to, and have all the options that they deserve to figure out how they want to have babies if they choose to.
Agreed. Agreed. So it's noble, noble work.
Thank you. Ditto. Yeah.
So glad you've been doing this podcast and creating this resource for our community for a long time now.
Yeah, I don't know how it's still going, but it's still going. And it's awesome. I keep hearing stories that I haven't heard, which is crazy.
Yeah, we talk a lot in the book about like how just awesome and creative and brilliant like we are for how we pull this all together and create our families.
And also, like, it's a lot of system hacking, like the systems of family, the systems of like legal formation are just not designed for us. And so, you know, really, up until like the last few years, like people have just been like using community wisdom and like through storytelling, figuring out how to find a pathway forward when like there's just like no model.
Right.
You know, there was like one or two books 15 years ago, and then like more stories have been like put into print. And now there's like, you know, this is there's like the second guidebook coming out. Like, you know.
I mean, your book is super inclusive and doing the stuff, and all these new books are coming out and just like breaking down the freaking barriers and changing it. And that's what needs to happen.
Right. But like, our community deserves more than a handful of books. Our community deserves healthcare that's like designed around our needs, and insurance coverage that's going to match it, you know?
And representation.
It's like, if you want to like know what it's like to experience homophobia in adulthood, you like should have a queer baby. It's just like, you know? So I'm like, I feel like I haven't really experienced much homophobia. I mean, a little bit in midwifery school, but mostly like since I was a teenager. And then I'm like, oh,
right.
Great new opportunity. I was like missing out on this.
The little microaggressions. And then you can't hide anymore. You can't just let people assume what they want to assume. You can't let the cab driver assume you're going to go visit your boyfriend. No, actually, I'm going to see my wife. I have a wife and she has two moms. You know what I mean? Like, you have to be out and proud all the freaking time. And that's another.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
We had our first fun experience having to go to the children's hospital last week. And I like was kind of hitting a wall with getting misgendered and being called mom. And my partner was like, you know, if we say anything, it's going to be worse because then you're going to be actively getting misgendered. And I was like, I know, I don't want to say anything. And so then my partner said something and they're like, okay, so what do you want to be called? And I was like, I just want to be called by my name. And so like, okay, so mom wants to go by Ray and dad wants to go by Asher. And we're like, actually, we're just the parents. You can call me Baba, but like no one here is going to do that. So just try and call me by my name. And yeah, and then I was like actively getting misgendered for the rest of the experience. And I was like, oh my God.
Well, that's the conundrum though. That's the thing. Like, am I going to say something and then have to take offense every time it's wrong?
Yeah. Right. And also like, am I suddenly like being read as a cis het couple because I had a baby? And so suddenly my partner became a man.
I'm
like,
of course you are. Of course. Yeah. Right. Because we don't have any other language or the systems don't. We're going to get there, but it's a work in progress. But I'm so glad y'all are doing what you're doing. Tell everybody where they can find you and where they can find your book and all this stuff.
Okay. You can find me at restoremidwifery.com or on Instagram at restoremidwifery. I also started an online membership community that is supporting people who are trying to conceive and pregnant people. It's called Pregnant Together. And we do like weekly Q&As and a lot of community building stuff because I think there's a lot of isolation that can happen. And also, as Ray mentioned, introducing tons more people to the midwifery model of care, even if they don't want to have a home birth or work with a midwife, and just trying to make it more accessible. So that's exciting.
I love that.
And you can find this awesome book, Baby Making for Everybody, Fertility and Family Building for LGBTQ+ and solo parents. You can order anywhere. We have an Instagram, Baby Making for Everybody.
Okay.
And also follow. The website is www.babymakingforeverybody.com.
Perfect. That's easy to remember.
Yes.
And Ray, anything to add?
Yeah. So in addition to our book, you can find me at Refuge Midwifery on Instagram or refugemidwifery.com. If you're in the Philly area, my practice organizes a potluck for LGBTQ+ people who are trying to conceive, pregnant, or have new babies. It used to be every other month until the pandemic, and now it is when it is warm out because it is outside. There's a listserv if you email our practice that we can just add you to, so you also get the updates about future picnics, or just follow me on Instagram, and they're open to everyone that's not in my practice because we need community and we need peers who've gone through this before.
I love it.
And I know for me, like, yeah, just the handful of like queer parent friends I have who are giving birth around this time, or I have a couple of clients who I midwifed for who are like kind of taking me under their wing. It is so special and so necessary to like have queer parent community. So
it really is. It really is. And you're doing the good work. And even if somebody's not interested in a home birth, midwifery can still help you, right? And
oh, so much.
Like this whole fourth trimester conversation, I felt like all care just dropped off after they ripped that baby out of me and I was on my own, and it was hard. And I think I really could have benefited from a midwife who could just help me through it. You know, I had my wife, but there's limitations. So
totally.
So now y'all know at home. So go do all the following and go to the potluck and do the things and get that community going. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
The Queer Family Podcast.
Well, folks, I really hope you enjoyed that episode. I know I did. What a good story. But the conversation is not over, folks. Be sure you're following the show on all the socials. We're on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at the Queer Family Podcast. You're going to get photos of all the guests there, some videos, and just, you know, all around fun from yours truly. Who doesn't want that? Don't miss out. You don't want FOMO. Nobody wants FOMO. And don't forget to join me on Patreon to help me create this super important queer content. You're going to head to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast to sign up and get that bonus content. And one more thing, if you love this show and want to represent your love for us and our beautiful families, you need to head to our shop and get some Queer Family Podcast merchandise. We've got so many designs, and you can put these designs on any product in the store. We've got t-shirts, mugs, hoodies, notebooks, face masks, laptop cases. You're just going to go to tpublic.com and search for the Queer Family Podcast. Or you can find the shop on our website at thequeerfamilypodcast.com. There's so many ways, so many ways. All right, folks, that's it for this week. Tune back in next week for another episode all about family, but with gay.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.